It's history with a twist. You're listening to the Alternate History Show with Ben Kearns.
You certainly are. And welcome to episode 10 of the Alternate History Show. We've reached the magic 10, and I promise you, this show is going to be literally out of this world. I mean it. We're talking space travel today. We're going to be joined by award-winning author Matthew Kressel to discuss this very subject. In particular, we'll be asking and answering, what would it have taken for people to walk on the moon 2 decades earlier than it happened in real life? Also, what if the space program had accelerated or slowed down after the Second World War? We'll be talking about the moon landing. In particular, what could have led to a joint US-Soviet moon landing? And what if Aldrin and Armstrong had been stranded on the moon as feared? We'll take in some post-Apollo alternate history as well, including life on Mars, or at least humans on Mars, in the 80s and beyond. Could it have happened? Also, what if there had been no Challenger disaster? And imagine a US astronaut as president of the United States. It could have happened. As well as that, The Road is Lit with Moon and Stars is a short story published by Bruno Lombardi. I'll be giving it the 60-second summary treatment later on. And in part 3 of the Alternate History Show today, we'll be hearing about the Ukraine anthology, put together lovingly by alternate history fan David Flynn, and raising money for the effort in Ukraine. That's all to come on this edition of the Alternate History Show. Our title of the show today is quite simply Outer Space. And it does what it says on the tin, really. And to talk about it today, I am joined by a guy who was on last time, actually. He was on about a month ago, talking about the Allo Americana anthology. He was part of it, and he's part of this show now. Matthew Kressel, good afternoon.
Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be.
Well, let's talk about how you got into alternate history. Tell us about how it all started for you.
In a funky kind of way, it has to do with the topic we'll be talking about on the show today, because I was born and raised and grew up around Huntsville, Alabama, which is home to NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center and the U.S. Space and Rocket Center, which is a massive museum here. We're the only place in the world with 2 Saturn V rockets from the Apollo era, though one of them is fake, but don't tell anybody that. I had an interest in space from a very young age, and there's a bit of a joke in the family that I basically came out of the womb a nerd. And I was very interested in a lot of the NASA stuff from the 60s and whatnot, and stuff that didn't happen, so that was kind of where my interest began. But I think my introduction to it was things like Sliders, which was the 90s TV series that aired here on Fox in the US that my dad in particular was a bit of a fan of in its early season. And I was also given, I think I was around Christmas 97, 98, the Titanic Adventure at a Time video game, which, for people who don't know, put you in the place of a British secret agent on the Titanic the night it hits the iceberg and sinks, but you have the opportunity to change history by recovering certain artifacts that can stop World War I, the Russian Revolution, and World War II. But I didn't come to literary alternate history until my teens, when I came across, I think there's an anthology called The Greatest Alternate History Stories of the 20th Century, was in one of my local public libraries in a small Alabama town. And that was kind of the beginning of things, in a way. It's been an on and off interest since my teens. I kind of wandered in and out of it till a couple of years ago. We were talking about 2020 before the recording started, and that kind of got me back into it, because I was stuck here at home for 4.5 months, kind of furloughed, and being the writer that I am, I was looking for stuff to write, and I happened to see a listing on a science fiction and horror writing group on Facebook for people looking for alternate history stories for an anthology called Alternate Australia, being put out by Jared Kevin on Sea Lion Press. And that got me back into it in a big way, because not only did I write a story for that, which to my Shock, Horror, and Surprise won the Sidewise Award, of all things, but introduced me to Sea Lion Press, who's now published a novel of mine that I'd written back in 2017, 2018, and a couple of more short stories since then, including the one in Allo Americana.
And the one we'll be talking about a little bit later on with David Flynn and the rest of the team on the Ukraine. All right, well, let's start by talking about what we're meant to be talking about this afternoon. And today it is, of course, space travel. We're going out of space. Realistically, Matthew, what do you think is the earliest time that space travel and space exploration could have taken place with a point of departure after 1900?
The earliest in terms of getting a human being into space,
yes,
for me is probably around the late 40s, early 50s. What you need to have happen is the development of what we would today consider primitive rocket technology that takes place starting in kind of the 1920s into the 30s, and of course sort of really culminates in Nazi Germany developing the V2 rocket.
Yes.
During World War II. The V2 is very much the precursor to basically everything that happens afterwards.
Yeah.
You know, it's been said before, and I don't think it's necessarily a wrong piece of analysis, that really, as ineffective as a weapon the V2 was, it did save everybody else millions of dollars and rubles and probably years, if not a decade, in development costs and time. And I think sort of the earliest period you can get where somebody is going to get into space is probably about 1949, 1950. And ironically, the people to do it wouldn't have been the Americans or the Russians, but it would have been the British. What needs to go slightly differently, and it is slightly differently, is a bureaucrat not throwing away a particular proposal sent to them by the British Interplanetary Society in 1946.
Tell us about this.
So it's known as Mega Rock.
Right.
M-E-G-A-R-O-C.
Okay.
And this was a proposal that was put forward by the British Interplanetary Society to the Ministry of Supply in 1946. So let's take a step back to a couple of years earlier. V2 rockets coming down on parts of the UK, particularly London, also parts of France and Belgium.
Yes.
As Arthur C. Clarke, who was head of the British Interplanetary Society at different times, said, it was the moment when space travel went from being complete science fiction to a possibility. At the end of World War II, one of the big scrambles, as people are likely aware of, was for V2 rocket technology. Today, we tend to think of that as being between the Americans and the Soviet Union. The British were involved in this too, and the British captured a whole number of V2 rockets. And in 1945 into 46, begin launching them as part of something called, of all things, Operation Backfire.
You gotta love our irony, you really have.
It's one of the things I love the British for, being an Anglophile. But having launched a bunch of these V2s, and with, of course, members of the British Interplanetary Society being involved through military and civilian ways, they had figured out that the V2 was a perfect for modifying. That if you slightly elongated it, if you make it a little bit wider, and if you replace that warhead on top with a capsule, you could do a suborbital spaceflight using a V2. A modified V2, but you could do it. And the Ministry of Supply still had some V2 rockets left over that hadn't been launched as part of Operation Backfire. So there is a possibility. And I'll admit that I've written about this in my own fiction in a couple of different places, that if somebody, a bureaucrat presumably, at the Ministry of Supply in 1946 had seen this proposal and not gone, thank you, but no thank you, Britain, without actually having to change very much, could have put the first man in space as early as 1949, 1950. Because what Mega Rock was proposing was essentially what NASA would do in 1961 with the first two Mercury Redstone launches, carrying Alan Shepard and Gus Grissom. But it could have been just as equally some dashing RAF pilot from the World War II period.
Wow, whole 40 years before Helen Sharman and all that lot in the 90s. Indeed. What would have happened from then on? Would the Jeff Bezoses of the world, I suppose, be talking about going on holiday to all these planets and stuff like that, perhaps, now, if that had happened in 1949, 1950, a whole 20 years before the moon landings in what we call real life?
Possibly. I mean, the big question is what would have happened in terms of the development after that? Would it have been seen as this kind of glorious one-off, or would the British government, keeping in mind the austerity and the financial situation that Britain finds itself in at the end of World War II, the empire coming apart in all the decolonization and all of that? I could imagine a scenario where, and perhaps this is a bit out there, but Clement Attlee perhaps facing a choice between Britain can build the bomb or Britain can control the high ground of space. There's a wonderful phrase that's actually used a couple of decades later by another bureaucrat somewhere in the British government to get rid of Britain's real-life satellite launching capability in the 60s of a vertical empire. You may lose India, you may lose the African colonies, but we'll have the high ground of space. We can have space stations and possibly trips to the moon and all that.
It makes me wonder as well, because none other than Winston Churchill, I think around them at this time, said that his aim was to get Britain to be Greece to America's Rome. I wonder whether that would have played into it in this scenario, and whether that would have played out more efficiently up towards Suez, perhaps.
It might have, and it may even have changed the dynamics of the special relationship. With apologies to the listeners in the UK, but I remember during the Bush era, you know, there was kind of these funny illustrations here in the UK, or here in the US, I should say, of Tony Blair being basically Bush's lapdog, and the kind of the weird lopsided way the special relationship has worked in places. I could imagine that having space technology, of having that high ground, may, if the Cold War progresses the way it did in real life, could give Britain the kind of leverage that it started lacking from there. But it's entirely possible too. You know, you think about the brain drain out of the UK in the 60s in particular, you know, with the cancellation of things like the TSR2, that may have happened with space technology as well. So it may have just been a slightly different version of what happened in reality.
Let's talk about the early development of rockets in the sort of 1920s and 1930s. What if that had gone slightly differently? How could it have gone slightly differently as well from a layman's point of view?
So one of the big things that could have gone differently would have been actually, again, going to the UK. Now, the British Interplanetary Society is founded sometime in the 20s and 30s.
Yes.
I'm blanking on the exact date. But the problem that the British Interplanetary Society had, and to some extent still has to this day, is they could do a lot of the theoretical work, but they couldn't actually do the actual building and the physical construction that was needed. And the reason for that is a wonderful law that's on the books. It's the Explosives Act of 1875.
Oh, I think I've heard about this.
And it actually is the biggest problem that British spaceflight enthusiasts have in the 1920s and 30s, when rocket fever is taking over parts of the US and is taking over in Germany and even in the Soviet Union. Everybody else was building rockets.
Yes.
And doing the theoretical work to go with it. And the UK was just stuck. The one big thing that might have changed a lot of this would have been somebody in government in any of these countries. To some extent, it was happening in Germany. There would have had to have been an infusion of cash into development and whatnot.
Yeah.
But, you know, that could have got everything going 10 years sooner than it did in real life.
Which would have been interesting if the sort of early space exploration and the building of rockets had taken off, in particular in Germany. What would be the effects of that, do you reckon?
I think what it might have done in terms of talking about Germany would have been something like the V2 coming along, not at the end of the war, but perhaps at the beginning of the war. Or indeed, one of the reasons that the V2 rocketry was so focused on by the German army, even into the pre-Nazi period, was the fact that it was one of those few potential weapon systems that wasn't covered by the wonderful Treaty of Versailles. And what might have happened is, instead of the V2 showing up at the end of the war as kind of a terror weapon that in the end kills more people building it than it does actually being used as a weapon proper, could have been used to do things like the Blitz. And it could have made things infinitely worse.
That would have made things interesting and would have certainly exacerbated the need for the US to get involved from the UK's perspective post Pearl Harbor and even pre Pearl Harbor, really.
Yeah, it could very well have. The other question there is that if the development starts long enough in advance, does anybody start thinking about intercontinental capabilities? Do things like the America Bomber or Von Braun's America Rocket, which are on the drawing board at the end of the war, could they have been sitting there ready to have potentially held off a transatlantic alliance by saying, you know, if you enter the war, we're not just going to sink your ships with our submarines, but we could potentially put a missile on New York, Boston, Washington, you name it.
With the Luftwaffe feared as it was in the late 30s as well, that would have exacerbated things. But then there was enough fear anyway, so would that be counteracted by the increased need to get involved to stop Nazi Germany, if that makes sense?
The best answer I have to that is actually to point people to fiction. There's a book by, I believe it's Alan Steele, VS Day.
Yeah.
Which may have been talked about on the podcast before. Basically imagines the U.S. getting involved in kind of a Manhattan Project-style mad rush space race for a weapon against Nazi Germany's America Bomber in 1942-43. I could foresee a version of that taking place, potentially. Maybe not the way that Steele imagined it, but you could certainly have had a situation like that involved. But again, might have started everything 5 to 10 years sooner than it did in real life.
I'm going to move on now to the Second World War period, actually, and I'd like to talk about the idea of the Western powers, America, not co-opting the likes of Wernher Braun, which was controversial. What if that hadn't been done, or at least hadn't been done to the degree that it was?
We tend to forget that Robert Goddard is here in the U.S. developing rockets. Mm. And also, the Jet Propulsion Lab, before it becomes part of NASA, is working on rocketry and stuff in the 1940s. In fact, members of the JPL are sent over to Germany at the end of the war, before von Braun comes to the U.S. to interrogate him and ask him questions. So what really happens there is that we never developed the rocket technology. You know, Robert Goddard was kind of shunned. He was working in all places outside of Roswell, New Mexico, launching his small rockets throughout the 20s and 30s.
Mm.
What should have happened in some ways would have been a similar investment to what Germany did with von Braun and Hermann Oberth in building things like the V-2. But of course, that didn't happen. And if it had happened, see my previous answer. But what might have happened, as happened with other bits of captured German technology and indeed Japanese technology at the end of the war, U.S. experts could have looked at what had been developed, could have asked von Braun and his team questions, left them in Germany, or brought them here to the U.S. and put them down somewhere where they couldn't easily be gotten to by the Soviets, which was part of the reason for bringing them here to the U.S. to begin with.
The idea that if we didn't, the Soviets would, basically, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And that, in fact, did happen at the end of the war, with the Soviets having realized that there was some value to the V-2, go in 1945-46 and actually scoop up all of the Nazi scientists, basically, they can find who are left. And they ship them to Siberia, and they have them building the R-1, which is the Soviet carbon copy of the V-2. And as soon as they've learned everything they can from the Germans, they send the Germans back to East Germany. Something like that could have happened with the U.S. And the V-2, as it was for the Russians, could have been the basis of it without having had von Braun become, not necessarily a figurehead, but he became kind of a voice, in a way, here in the U.S., in the post-war pre-Sputnik period, you know, on things like these three documentaries he does with Disney. I think what would have happened without a von Braun being here, and again, I say this growing up in Huntsville, and Huntsville is very much a town that is put on the map in a big way by von Braun and his German team showing up here. So his legacy is here is just as complicated as it is anywhere else.
Yes, yeah.
So much so that our local civic center, where we hold basketball and hockey games and music concerts, is called the Von Braun Center, if you want an understanding of how important he is to the community.
His legacy is complicated.
Very complicated, to put it mildly. Mm. But what might have happened, as I was saying, is that you could take the technology and whatnot and build on that without necessarily bringing that team over. So you would have a similar development to what happened, but I don't think it would have the kind of popular support that it did without having somebody like Von Braun putting his case before the American public. Mm. Maybe somebody else would have rose to the fore. I don't know. There's nobody obvious from that period, but that may well be because Von Braun is taking so much of the limelight.
And that would have inevitably, I'm presuming, assuming no one else does come forward, that would have led to a delay in terms of the space program for a significant enough period of time.
Possibly. Mm. I mean, the question is, what's happening on the other side of the Iron Curtain at this point? Is Korolev sitting there still being the chief designer pushing the Russian ICBM program and eventually their space program?
Mm.
And the other thing to keep in mind, and I may be jumping the gun a bit, is that the Russians managed to get so far ahead by being technologically behind. We forget very much so that the early space program, particularly in the 50s into the 60s, well up until Apollo, is building on nuclear weapons capability. You need to be able to lob warheads at distances anywhere from a couple hundred miles to, you know, intercontinental distances.
Yeah.
That's what a lot of the effect that Sputnik has comes from, is if they can put this half a ton satellite into orbit with a dog on board, what else can they put down on our cities? So that's a lot of that.
Yeah.
But the Russians managed to get ahead by being behind, because very quickly the U.S. learned how to do something known as miniaturization, which, to put a very complicated thing into a simple enough package, to coin an expression, it's getting a bigger bang for your buck.
Okay.
You can have a smaller warhead that has a lot more explosive yield. The Russians took a lot longer than the U.S. did to figure out how to do that. So the Russians had to build what are known as heavy lift rockets. And that's what allowed them to get ahead so quickly. Because Sputnik weighs something like half a ton. The first American satellites weigh a matter of pounds.
Mm.
Because that was what we were expected to loft into space.
Conversely, I mean, what would have happened had Werner von Braun been co-opted by the Soviets in the mid-40s?
I think what would have happened to von Braun would have been what indeed happened to his fellow scientists. They would have been brought over, the Russians would have learned everything they could from him, they would have built a version of the R-1, and they would have said, thank you, Werner, we've learned everything we need, you can go home now. I don't think he would have become a major figure in the Russian space program.
Mm.
I think the Russians, as they did with the scientists they got, they were great at taking other people's ideas and technology and doing their own thing with it.
Let's focus a little bit more on post-World War II. And we did talk about Roswell. You mentioned Roswell a little while ago. And I do wonder what the political, what the implications generally would have been had there been no equivalent Roswell incident or anything like it. Whether that would have perhaps reduced the tempo of space-related conspiracy theories, what effect that could have had on things moving forward.
Well, I think we forget that Roswell doesn't become part of the UFO lore till the 1970s.
Mm.
Yes, this thing falls out of the sky in 1947. It becomes sort of a 24-hour news story. The Army Air Force here in the U.S., as it was then, comes out and says, oh, it's just a weather balloon, false alarm, carry on. Roswell doesn't enter a big part of the folklore until the 1970s. And by that time, a whole bunch of things have happened which changed that whole perspective quite a bit.
Mm.
Part of it, too, with the early UFO stuff is that people didn't necessarily think they were from outer space. They potentially thought they were from behind the Iron Curtain.
Yes.
And indeed, one of the reasons I can say this, having written a book on the UFO topic connected to the Dark Skies TV series from the 90s, is that a lot of why you have the kind of attitudes in officialdom that you do towards this subject of UFOs is the simple fact that what they were really concerned about was the Russians using the UFO phenomenon to come in and basically overwhelm our early warning system to drop bombs on us. But I think, you know, it could have changed things a little bit and might have allowed for, as we're now beginning to see, a slightly more serious and scientific interest in the topic rather than, oh my God, this is something we have to play down, which is in fact what happens with the Robertson panel out of the CIA and the Air Force in 1953, where basically it goes, there may be something here, we can't objectionably prove it, but it's a huge national security concern and we should do everything in our power to play it down.
Well, let's talk about the 1950s. I mean, what could have gone differently then to have sped up the space race or to have slowed it down, perhaps? Could the Americans have beaten Gagarin, perhaps, and got someone up into a spacewalk a little bit sooner?
Well, the U.S. could certainly have beaten both Sputnik and Kerguelen. Von Braun actually proposed in the mid-50s something known as Project Orbiter, and actually had a rocket ready to go, actually sat in the hangar here in Huntsville, not too many miles from where I'm sitting now, for the better part of 2 years, waiting to actually launch something. And there was actually a big thing known as the International Geophysical Year that was done, I believe, in 56, 57.
Yes.
It was a whole bunch of scientific research. Mm. And the U.S. announced it was going to launch a satellite as part of that. And all of the service branches, the military service branches, put in bids on who was going to do it, basically.
Yeah.
Von Braun representing the Army. There was a small group from the Air Force, but the Air Force is still very early on in ICBM technology development. So at that point, nuclear rockets really belonged to the Army still, through a thing here in Huntsville known as the Army Ballistic Missile Agency. And also the Navy has been developing one for various reasons. And there are various reasons.
Yes.
Including the fact that Eisenhower, who's the president at the time, is desperate to do overflights of the Soviet Union for what we now call overhead reconnaissance, and was desperate that the first satellite, if it was going to be American, would not be launched by a nuclear missile, basically, decided to go with the Navy. In fact, von Braun was actually forbidden from launching his rockets above a certain altitude and carrying certain payloads to avoid him accidentally, in inverted commas, putting the first American satellite into space.
Which must have been, given what we know about him, must have been very frustrating for him.
Hugely frustrating. And it ends up with Eisenhower and his administration having massive amount of egg on their face in October 57 and sort of winter 57-58 when Sputnik goes up.
Yes.
Because von Braun gets called before congressional committees and is said, why did you not put a satellite first?
Yeah.
And von Braun's got the receipts, and he can go,
guys, hate to say I told you so.
Exactly.
It is the Alternate History Show. This is Ben with you for another hour, joined by author, award-winning author, of course, to give him his full title, Matthew Kressel. More from him in the next part of the Alternate History Show. First off, I thought we'd take a bit of a detour to do the 60-second summary today. Now, this is an occasional feature that I like to do on the Alternate History Show, where I take a piece of literature or alternate history media, as long as it's AH-related, I take it and review it in the space of 60 seconds so you can make up your mind rather swiftly about whether to buy a copy. And I would strongly suggest that you get a hold of this by an author called Bruno Lombardi. It's called The Road Was Lit with Moon and Stars. And it's all about space travel, hence why I'm talking about it for you now. And I've got to do it within the space of a minute, so I better start now, really. The Road Was Lit with Moon and Stars is all about the Apollo 12 mission to the moon in September of 1970, following the unsuccessful moon landings in July of 1969. In this timeline, Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong having perished after crashing into the moon's surface. The story is focused on a man called David Patton, who was not an astronaut in real life, but became so in this timeline, and was evidently one of the first people to set foot on the moon alive, along with a certain Alan Shepard as well. In particular, one thing that troubles Mr. Patton is what the words he will say will be. And of course, he wouldn't have known what Neil Armstrong would say at that point, so he had to work that out himself. But what words did he say? Did he make it to the moon? You'll have to buy it to find out, and I suggest that you do. The Road Was Lit with Moon and Stars by Bruno Lombardi. Right, part two of the Alternate History Show is coming up. In it, we'll talk more with Matthew about the alternate history of space travel. In particular, we'll be discussing the idea of an American in space becoming the first man in space, beating a certain Mr. Gagarin. Also, what if there had been no Sputnik crisis in the late 50s, early 60s? And what if there had been more confidence amongst NASA? Also, could there have been any difference if Kennedy had not stood up and said that within a decade, a man will be on the moon? And what if the moon landings had gone wrong somehow? All that mob size and a bit of Apollo action from the 70s, all in part two of the Alternate History Show.
This is the Alternate History Show. We revisit the past, change it, and see what happens. Enough said.
I wonder what the implications would be of von Braun's plans actually being given the go-ahead. How would that have affected things politically, and how would that have played out in terms of general space travel?
That's a good question, because a lot of what happens in the mid-50s all the way to the tail end of the 60s is driven by the space race. The space race, of course, being an extension of the Cold War. There's an argument to be made that had von Braun gotten his way in 56 to put the first satellite into space and beaten the Russians, you never have what comes to be known as the Sputnik moment. It's entirely possible that things proceeded a lot slower of a pace than they did in real life. For example, Arthur C. Clarke, mentioning him again, had in 53, I think it was, 53, yep, 54, published a book called Prelude to Space, imagining the first crewed mission to the moon taking place in the 1970s. And that was kind of the expectation, that it might be the end of the century before somebody got to the moon, that we were taking steps without a massive infusion of cash. Nobody was ever going to get there. So that may have been, in fact, the consequence of that was you get no space race. And that's certainly true of what happens 4 or 5 years later with Gagarin, because von Braun plays a role in that story too. There's an undeclared race to put the first person in space. Everybody assumes it's going to be the Americans, even the Soviets. And in early 61, I think it's in March of 61, the Mercury Redstone 2 launch happens. And of course, Redstone is the rocket built by von Braun, a version of which puts up Explorer 1, the first U.S. satellite, in 58. They do a test launch with, I believe it's Ham, a chimpanzee, on board. And the launch is mostly successful. However, one of the valves on the engine for the Redstone gets stuck. So the rocket goes higher, faster, and further than it was supposed to have. If an astronaut, Alan Shepard, who had already been picked to be America's first man in space, had been on board, somebody could have flicked a couple of switches and everything would have been fine. But there wasn't. There was a chimp on board. And von Braun, being the conservative engineer that he is, basically goes, we have to have another launch that gets everything right and make absolutely sure before we put a human being on board. Alan Shepard, who've mentioned before, Chris Kraft, who's essentially running mission control at this point, or what's going to become mission control, much of that side of NASA's going, we know what went wrong. If Shepard had been on board, he could have flipped a switch. Let's just go ahead and go. Von Braun wins the battle, arguing with Jim Webb, who's the NASA administrator in Washington, that they need to do one more test flight. And it's that test flight that opens the window for Yuri Gagarin to be the first man in space. And there's a wonderful book by Stephen Walker called Beyond, which for anybody who's interested in this period, I highly recommend. Because what Walker demonstrates, and has been demonstrated before by others, including the wonderful historian James Logsdon, is that there's an interesting confluence of events in the spring of 1961. On April 12th, Yuri Gagarin becomes the first man in space. Big Soviet victory. Later that week, Cuban exiles trained by the CIA land at the Bay of Pigs. Massive disaster for the incoming Kennedy administration. JFK, barely in the White House 100 days, is looking for a piece of good news. And he finds it by going to NASA. So it's entirely possible, had von Braun gotten his way in 56, or not gotten his way in early 61, that the space race as we know it may never have happened.
And Alan Shepard would be a whole lot more well-known.
There would be a holiday named after him where people go and party and celebrate all things space.
That could have gone either way for alternate space travel in that scenario, because Kennedy would feel less need to make his pledge that at some point before the end of the decade, someone in the US, an American, is going to land on the moon.
In fact, if Kennedy's scientific advisor, Dr. Jerome Wiesner, had had his way, and this is another one of the great ironies of history, Wiesner is very much against what was then known as manned space flight, thought it was a huge waste of money. And on the very day, if memory serves, that Gagarin goes up, it's at least the same week, Wiesner drops a big report on JFK's desk that basically says Mercury is a huge waste of money. There's too many unknowns, and we don't even know if a human being can go into space and come back and survive.
Oh, JFK had quite the week that week. Let's talk about that comment then, that a man is going to land on the moon and come back down to Earth safely by the end of the decade. Even assuming he says that, as is the case in real life, that doesn't necessarily follow that it will happen, of course, does it? I've heard this said as well, that if he hadn't been assassinated in 1963, that would have just been seen as a promise that a politician made and probably shouldn't have made, rather than we've got to do what JFK wants now, we've got to fulfill his memory and get someone into space and get someone on the moon.
So that's where we get to some interesting alternate history territory, because, of course, middle of Kennedy's term, October 62, Cuban Missile Crisis happens.
Yes.
Perhaps the closest the world has ever come to nuclear war. Kennedy and Khrushchev in the Kremlin are desperately looking for ways to dial down the Cold War, to cut expenditure, to figure out ways of cooperation.
Mm.
And Kennedy in particular hits upon the idea of a joint mission to the moon. Both sides are working on the technology. They're duplicating each other's work to some extent. Why should everybody spend huge amounts of money to learn how to do the exact same thing when we can work together? Kennedy actually, in a speech, I believe it's in September of 1963, at the United Nations, actually puts the proposal before the public. There's almost immediately pushback against it within NASA, within the U.S. Congress, but Khrushchev is surprisingly receptive to the idea. And there were already beginning to be some low-level talks at figuring out how to make it work. So if Kennedy doesn't die November 22nd, 1963, there's a possibility that there could be a summit meeting in Moscow or somewhere in Europe in 64, 65, perhaps after the 64 election is over with, where a deal is struck. And maybe they don't get to the moon in 69, maybe it's in the early 70s in the first term of whoever Kennedy's successor is.
Mm.
But supposing there's no Vietnam War, which is entirely possible in my view with Kennedy living, you could have a joint U.S.-Soviet mission to the moon at the tail end of the 60s or even the early 70s. There is no space race at that point. There's international cooperation.
Yeah.
But like we're seeing today with the International Space Station circling over our heads every 90 minutes, that's also at the mercy of international politics and what's going
on
in the scene.
Yeah. But then, as I say, could a joint space exploration program have happened even after JFK's assassination under LBJ or someone else in the future?
Probably not under Johnson, because Johnson, we think of JFK as the NASA president, as the space president. It's Lyndon Johnson who really pushes it through. And also, keeping in mind the political atmosphere of the early 60s, particularly around the 64 election, Barry Goldwater being his opponent in that election, you know, venomously anti-communist.
Of course.
Also, after Kennedy's death, Congress actually passes a law. They actually write it into the space appropriation budget to actually bar any cooperation on a lunar mission between NASA and the Soviet Union. It'll happen, I suspect, if it happens at all. Because it did happen sort of with Apollo Soyuz.
Yeah.
In 1975, but the agreements for that were struck in the early 70s under the Nixon administration in deals with Brezhnev's regime in the Kremlin. It's entirely possible if the Soviet lunar program is going better than it actually did in real life, where their rocket keeps blowing up either on the launch pad or X amount of seconds into flight, that there could have been a deal struck between the Nixon administration and Brezhnev.
Okay.
To say, let's build a joint lunar base, or let's continue joint exploration of the moon, or even going to Mars in the 80s, because that was the big push after Apollo.
Of course, yeah, which we will come on to a little bit later on. Let's talk Apollo now. With a point of departure around about the start of Apollo 1, could things have progressed more rapidly?
Apollo 1 not happening opens up a whole can of worms. Because on the one hand, you don't lose three astronauts on the launch pad in a routine test.
Yeah.
You don't have really a big dip in public support at that point, which has a massive ramifications for the Apollo era, or the post-Apollo era, I should say. Because it's at that point that Congress guts what's known as the Apollo Applications Project. But if Apollo 1 doesn't happen where it happens, you're setting the stage for something infinitely worse to happen, which is losing three astronauts in space, which is infinitely worse than losing three guys on the launch pad during a test. So Apollo 1 not happening could be a good thing, but it's also a bad thing, because the big thing that Apollo 1 does, and Chris Kraft, who I mentioned earlier, observed this, is it made them stop It made them look at everything they had done and to go, we can improve upon this. And it probably saved lives later on. So if Apollo 1 doesn't happen on January 27th, 1967, it's going to potentially lead to something infinitely worse when the eyes of the world are upon the mission somewhere on the moon. It could be Apollo 8. It could be, heaven forbid, Apollo 11. But all it's going to take is a spark in that spacecraft, and boom. You could potentially lose three astronauts on live TV.
Well, let's focus on the big event then, July 1969, and the race to the moon. I don't know whether you read Bruno Lombardi's short story about this.
I have not come across it, I'm saying.
Basically, in 1970, the first free men, including Alan Shepard, evidently, try and get to the moon 1 year after the Apollo 11 astronauts crash into the moon, basically. From the perspective of the guy who will, instead of Armstrong, be saying the first words, so to speak. It's an interesting read if anyone wants to get a hold of it. It's part of a wider anthology as well. In that, it took about a year from the failed Apollo 11 crashing into the moon to Apollo 12 going into the moon successfully. That was around about September 1970, if I remember rightly. Of course, in a scenario where Armstrong and Aldrin don't make it back, you got the likes of William Proxmire and Walter Mondale in Congress saying perhaps we should scale back on this or not do anything in the future, not go to the moon again. And then on the other hand, you've got the pressure to make sure everything's okay. Apollo 11 crashed, Apollo 12 has got to come back properly. Then those, I would imagine, even relatives of Armstrong and Aldrin themselves, perhaps saying, do what Neil and Buzz tried to do, that's what they would want, etc. So you'd have a multitude of pressures. With that in mind, is a year about the right time, do you think, for a follow-up moon landing in a scenario where Apollo 11 crashes or cannot come back?
I think a year, possibly two. 18 months, what the difference between the two, would work.
Okay.
You know, NASA had a lot of telemetry data and stuff coming in, and they would have been able to do, as they in fact did after every mission, and also after Apollo 13, which is the closest analog we have to this scenario.
Yes.
You go through the data, and you go, what went wrong? And they would have figured out what had happened.
Yeah.
And it may have been something as simple as realizing that, hey, it may be important to flip off a particular switch on the control panel, which is in fact what happened on Apollo 11 that caused the famous 1201, 1202 alarm.
That famous incident with the felt tip pen, or the ballpoint pen, or whatever it was.
You could have done it. Certainly, besides Bruno's story, there's been a handful of other things. I know there's an audio drama that BBC Radio 4 did called Forever Mankind about 10 years ago that explored a similar scenario. I think there would have been a public outcry that you have to bring these guys home. You know, they may not be alive, but you've got to bring them home and give them a hero's burial. Honor these guys for who they were and what they tried to accomplish.
Yeah.
What happens after that is the big question.
And I wonder how this would affect the world's psyche in this scenario and the depictions of the space race, and how this would have affected things politically as well, given that, well, the Apollo 11 astronauts would have died on TV in some way, either having landed on the moon and not been able to get back, or having crashed into the moon, as was the case in Bruno's story.
That's a good question. You know, there's a speech that's actually prepared.
Yes.
By William Safire, who's a writer, speechwriter for Richard Nixon.
I think it's in his library, isn't it?
They have it there, and also it's been republished in some other places. I have it in a book here on my shelf called Almost History that talks about all this, and there's a wonderful phrase towards the end of that speech that from now on there will always be a portion of the moon that will be forever mankind. It's a wonderful kind of poetic phrase, and I think it would have summed up the tragedy of the situation rather well.
I mean, whenever I read that speech, I can literally just hear Nixon's tones in that speech.
So I think it would have been a big effect on the psyche. It may have extenuated the circumstances that the Russians go, okay, the Americans have failed. We have a reason to now fix the problems with the N1 rocket and actually get our own cosmonauts there. If nothing else, there would have been at least an Apollo 12. You know, if it doesn't happen in 1970, it'll happen in 71, 72 to go recover them. What happens to Apollo and to human spaceflight after that is the big question.
I do wonder whether this could have even revived talk of a joint Soviet-American mission of some sort.
It could have. The other question here, getting back into conspiracy theory territory,
is
we know that the Russians had launched a probe, Luna 15, if memory serves, that crashes hundreds of miles away from the Sea of Tranquility where Armstrong and Aldrin are. But can you imagine the conspiracy theories being spread that the Russians actually shot down Apollo 11 and the Eagle lunar module on its way down? In some ways, it could have made detente impossible, especially if that view became popularly held in spite of all evidence.
If that had happened, coming back to what I mentioned a little bit earlier on, what would be the effects, do you reckon, on culture generally? Because, of course, you have David Bowie and Space Oddity here in the UK, and in the US you've got Star Trek and the like. What does that do to the culture and the idea of boldly going where no one has gone before?
But it may have turned the whole space race and the whole idea of these astronauts into these kind of tragic heroes. Keep in mind that the disenchantment, as it were, with the space race doesn't happen really till after Apollo, until after Apollo 11 and getting to the moon, and as one NASA historian put it, ringing the bell and saying the space race is over. That said, it may have created an atmosphere where people like Brian O'Leary, who was appointed to be an astronaut in 67 and left NASA almost immediately, ended up publishing a book in 71, I think it was, called The Memoirs of an Ex-Astronaut, that does pretty well in terms of sales and is really the first big chink in the armor of the image of what America thinks as astronauts are. That really gets taken apart at the tail end of the 70s when Tom Wolfe writes The Right Stuff. One of two things is going to happen. It's either going to cause all that to happen a bit sooner, or it's going to make publishers look at that and go, yeah, we can't do this. We can't do this, not with two guys on the moon dead.
It would be interesting then if that would happen subsequently after an alternate landing on the moon, Apollo 12 perhaps, in 1970. It would be interesting to see what a more mixed space program would have been like, and how the sort of backlash would have come to that in the sort of mid-70s as well, when things get really economically turbulent.
Right. I mean, we also forget that at one point after Apollo 13, Richard Nixon is seriously considering just ending human spaceflight altogether. There's plans put afoot to shut down the Space Center in Houston, to shut down or to at least downsize it. There's plans to shut down the Marshall Space Flight Center here in Huntsville, Alabama. And it's actually, of all people, Caspar Weinberger, who's going to become a Secretary of Defense under Ronald Reagan.
Yes.
Who in 1972 writes a memo. At this point, he's in the White House budget office, and he says, we can't afford the loss of prestige. More importantly, in the short term, we can't afford to lose the votes in all these states where aerospace is a huge thing. NASA's going to have to come up with a project. If you're not going to keep doing Apollo,
got to do something else.
That's the birth of the space shuttle.
And I was going to ask you about that. We will talk about a more successful, perhaps, space race post-moon landing in a little while. First of all, conversely, I do wonder, with what you said about Nixon and cancelling the space programs altogether, was that even possible? Was that even possible given what happened and given the amount invested, not only financially, but politically and culturally as well, in some sort of space travel in the future, and of course what it would do to jobs? Basically, what I'm trying to ask is, if Caspar Weinberger hadn't published that memo, would someone else have? And if not, what would have happened had Nixon actually gone ahead and cancelled all space flights?
That's a good question. Within NASA, people were fighting tooth and claw to save the space program. And in fact, of course, famously, there were three Apollo missions canceled. And at one point, if the Nixon administration had had their way, there would have been no Apollo 16 or 17 that did land on the moon. At one point, the plan was they were going to cut NASA's budget for fiscal year 1972, where they wouldn't have been able to do that. So certainly it's in the air that there's the possibility to do that. I mean, we forget now that the race to the moon was about beating the Russians to the moon. That was politically what it was about.
Yeah.
As much as we talk about the science and the sense of exploration, that was what it was really about. It's just an extension of the Cold War, for better or worse. Once that was done, the American public support for Apollo and for NASA goes downhill in a hurry. There's a big upsurge briefly during Apollo 13. There is around the time of Apollo 15, which takes the lunar rover to the moon. But at that point, the American public is asking the question that, to be fair, has been asked since about the 1950s when all this started. Couldn't we spend this money focusing on things at home? Politically, it's entirely possible to have done it. And I think he could have gotten away with it. Overall, in terms of international prestige, is the big question.
Yeah.
Particularly because the Soviets are still flying Soyuz and they are putting up the Salyut space stations. So I think what might have happened is Nixon could have pulled the plug, and then come Gerald Ford or even Jimmy Carter, somebody could have stood up and said, we've given up this capability. The Russians are ahead of us again. We've got to do something about this.
I do still wonder whether Nixon could have actually got away with it, politically speaking, at this time, because we're sort of moving up to election year in 1972. And of course, after that, you get Watergate and all that came with it. I mean, there's going to be some blowback, isn't there? Could that not even conversely perhaps give NASA more impetus and more support to carry on Apollo and space flights generally, especially if, say, Neil Armstrong or Buzz Aldrin or Michael Collins speak up and say we should carry on? Or would the political situation at home trump all, basically?
That's a good question, because a number of former astronauts at that point, Michael Collins included, were in different ranks within the federal bureaucracy at this point. Michael Collins, after he resigns from NASA shortly after Apollo 11, becomes Undersecretary of State for Public Relations, for example. Bill Anders, who was on Apollo 8, took the famous Earthrise photograph that most people, even if you know nothing about space, will be familiar with. I don't know if he's ambassador to Norway at this point, but he's certainly a member of the Atomic Energy Commission. So it's entirely possible that, as happened to Barack Obama 40 years later, when the shuttle program was being canceled, and you did have people like Neil Armstrong, Gene Cernan, and Jim Lovell coming before Congress or writing open letters, that something could have been done at that point. Whether it would have had an effect to cause a backpedaling to even get to what we did get in our timeline, or indeed to cause the inspiration to expand Apollo out further, is a different question. And I just think with the atmosphere of things in 72, Nixon could have gotten away with it. But I think what would have happened, we were talking about the cultural stuff earlier, is that when the disillusionment and the sense of malaise, to use Jimmy Carter's phrase from the other end of the decade, happens and sets in, maybe that could spur somebody like Ford or Carter or even Ronald Reagan, supposing Reagan still gets elected in 1980, to pick up the ball, as it were, and run with it.
And let's talk about the reverse situation, the idea that, of course, in 1969, a lot of people thought, well, today the moon, tomorrow Mars. Could that have possibly happened? Could Nixon have been made to be more enthusiastic about space? Was it simply that his nemesis, JFK, had championed space and Nixon was the anti-Kennedy, so he was going to do what he could to row back on Apollo and all things to do with the space race? Was it simply that, or was there another reason for him wanting to cancel? And could he have been persuaded to perhaps beat JFK in his own game and carry on the Apollo program, maybe expand it and maybe try and get a mission to Mars?
That was actually on the books and being talked about up till about 70-71. Spiro Agnew, his first vice president, leading the National Space Council.
That probably didn't help, knowing Agnew.
Agnew was a huge enthusiastic supporter for getting to Mars in the 1980s. I mean, there's political cartoons about it and everything else, which I don't think certainly helps. The surprising thing about Nixon, given that Nixon basically scouts the American space program, at least on the human spaceflight side, and indeed affected some of the robotic stuff being planned at that point for the 70s and 80s, is that he was initially an enthusiastic supporter of it. One of the people he brings in early in his administration is Frank Borman, who's the commander of Apollo 8, the first crewed mission to go to the moon. And he's enthusiastic to be there to meet the astronauts. I mean, he makes the famous phone call from the Oval Office to Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong on the moon. He goes out to the aircraft carrier out in the Pacific to meet the Apollo 11 astronauts when they come back with Frank Borman in tow. Fun fact, the carrier that was initially supposed to pick them up was the USS JFK. And it's Nixon who basically sends an order through the Pentagon that says that carrier will be diverted here and you will send something else.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not gonna greet the astronauts coming back from the moon on the USS John F. Kennedy.
Yeah.
So it ends up being, I believe it's the USS Iwo Jima instead. But he was a fairly enthusiastic supporter of it until Apollo 13 happened. In April 1970.
Yeah.
And that kind of changes Nixon's attitude in a lot of extents because it gave him a crisis he couldn't control. And Nixon kind of looks at it and goes, okay, well, if this had happened on my watch, it could have been bad if these guys hadn't come back.
Yeah.
And that starts changing the point of view. Maybe if Apollo 13 doesn't happen, maybe if Spiro Agnew is not quite as enthusiastic in punk about going to Mars.
Yeah, if at least he's not the most enthusiastic out of the lot, basically.
If you want to know how over-enthusiastic Agnew is, Agnew jumps on Air Force 2 when Apollo 13 happens, when the oxygen canister explodes and the crisis breaks out.
Yeah.
He's going to fly to Mission Control in Houston and be there. And it takes NASA making calls to the White House for somebody to tell them to put the plane back on the ground.
Mm.
And the last thing that NASA needs at that point is the Vice President of the United States with the press in tow walking around causing problems.
Mm. What would have been the implications of no Apollo 13 disaster and all that followed then?
There's two ways that could have gone. First off, if Apollo 13 is successful, there's arguably more reason to end the Apollo program sooner than you do in real life. So you could potentially have ended it before you ever got to Apollo 15, 16, 17, and in the lunar rover
beyond.
That really develops and delivers on the scientific side of what Apollo was pitched to be, which would have been a tragedy in its own right. Conversely, it may have proven that while this was an expensive venture, it's a sustainable venture.
Okay.
And not something that we have to worry about. It becomes routine. And it may even have, if somebody like Agnew or maybe even somebody else in the Nixon administration had dusted off the old Apollo application project ideas,
yeah,
which included Apollo-era lunar bases, that somebody could have extended it from there. And that might have changed things where you would have a permanent human presence on the moon later in the 70s, maybe even in the 80s.
Okay.
So something not a million miles removed from Apple TVs for All Mankind, though of course its point of departure for everything is of course that the Soviets get to the moon first.
And they talked of course about a man on Mars in the 80s. Does this happen in this scenario? Or is it possible?
Have. You look at what NASA's doing now, which is the idea, of course, to be fair, NASA's priorities seem to change every 4 to 8 years, depending on who's occupying the White House.
Yes, yeah.
But NASA's current planning, and indeed its planning on and off for the last 20 years or so, has been going back to the moon, establishing a lunar base, basically, learning how to live off the land off Earth, and then going to Mars. And I could foresee, in the 1970s, possibly under Nixon, but more likely under Ford or even Jimmy Carter, because Carter had an interest in it, but NASA was so focused on the shuttle, they never brought Carter anything that he could have delivered. It's Reagan who starts picking up that torch again.
Yeah.
But I could foresee a scenario where a lunar base in the 70s teaches NASA this is what it's like to live off the Earth, you know, and you don't have oxygen outside and you've got to deal with all this. And that can really pave the way in some extent to go to Mars in the 1980s.
It's an interesting idea, the idea of Jimmy Carter being seen as more of a space president, given the juxtaposition of what he was known for during his presidency in real life, the Malay speech and all that.
Carter's an interesting one from that point of view, because Carter, of course, is a nuclear engineer, trained by Hiram Rickover, who was the father of the U.S. nuclear submarine program. Carter's a very smart guy, he's a very smart engineer, and had an interest in space to an extent.
Yeah.
But NASA, because they were so focused on the shuttle, had nothing to bring to him in terms of long term. But if you read like his White House diary and stuff, there's two or three entries talking about like the Voyager probes and whatnot and being fascinated by that. It seems a shame that nobody came to him and said, we could put a man on Mars in your second term. All you have to do is get up and do a JFK style speech.
Yeah.
Of course, as we talked about, the Kennedy speech to go to the moon in 1961 is such a unique confluence of events.
Mm.
That I think part of the problem that the American space program has had since then is that everybody keeps waiting for that moment to happen again without understanding why that moment happened to begin with. But it potentially could have happened, particularly in 79 when detente collapses.
Mm.
Carter could have used it to offset what's happening in Afghanistan with the deterioration with the relationship with the Soviets and indeed the Iranian hostage crisis. Going out and saying, we are in a moment of malaise, but we need something to focus on. And that thing to focus on is we will go back to the moon and then to Mars in the next decade. Without the shuttle, NASA is freer in the 70s to actually do things besides pour all of their time, money, and research into robotic probes, which are doing incredible work. You think about the Voyager probes, for example. Hugely successful and open up the outer solar system to us for the first time in some respects.
Yeah.
But it's not people, and while there's public interest, it's not huge public interest. And on the other hand, all of the crewed spaceflight capability is being poured into the space shuttle, which is consistently behind schedule. It launches something like nearly 2 to 3 years behind schedule.
You have been listening to part two of the Alternate History Show. I'm glad you're enjoying the program so far. We're not done yet. Part three is on its way. If you give it a listen, we'd be delighted. In return, more from Matthew Kressel on the subject of space travel. In particular, could we have set foot on Mars in the 1980s or beyond? What would have happened had there been no 1986 Challenger disaster? John Glenn could well have become President of the United States in the 80s at some point or beforehand. What would the implications be of that? And how would it have affected NASA and space exploration generally? Also, Bush's strange 1992 ideas for space travel. More on all of that. Plus, a very special feedback hub for you today. You'll want to know more about that later on in part three. In it, we'll be hearing from a whole host of authors, including David Flynn and Matthew Kressel, about an anthology released to help those fleeing the war in Ukraine.
It's history with a twist. You're listening to the Alternate History Show with Ben Kearns.
Let's focus on space travel in the 1980s then. I mean, Reagan was somewhat infused about it as well. What could have happened in the early to mid-80s that didn't in real life, so to speak?
Well, having proven that the shuttle could work in inverted commas, because the shuttle never quite lived up to its expectation that it was going to be cheaper and more reliable and more reusable than the Saturn V. It lived up to being more reusable, but it definitely wasn't cheaper. In fact, by the end of the shuttle's life, if adjusted for inflation, it cost more money to launch the shuttle than it did the Saturn V. So that's irony for you. And to some extent, and I'm to risk being controversial, living in a NASA town that played a big role in developing the shuttle, there is a view in the space community that the shuttle basically created this 40-year technological cul-de-sac that basically got us stuck in low Earth orbit. But what might have happened with the early success of the shuttle would have been Reagan standing up earlier than his, I believe it's the 1984 State of the Union speech, and saying within 10 years we're going to build a space station. What Reagan potentially could have done is, as early as 82, 83, stood up and said, we're going to build it, we're going to build it sooner than that. And even somewhere in his second term, standing up and saying, let's go to Mars. John Logsdon, who's a historian of the American spaceflight, who I mentioned earlier, observed that Reagan was incredibly enthusiastic about the shuttle. He was incredibly enthusiastic about NASA. Reagan's problem was NASA, nor anybody else in his administration, brought him any major proposal for anything besides, let's just keep flying the shuttle and build the space station.
Of course, this is a time when John Glenn famously ran for president in 1984. I wonder whether he could have been made more prominent politically, or perhaps even have been president at some time around this point, and what the effects would have been of that.
President Glenn in 84, because Glenn is part of his running as for the Democratic nomination in 84, and they actually put him in direct contest with Walter Mondale. When he was running in 84, did put an emphasis on continuing the shuttle program, but also looking at other things, potentially going back to the moon or Mars, or at least getting NASA to start moving in that direction. I don't think we would have necessarily have seen anything major by 1992, which is when Glenn would have left office, assuming he got two terms. But it's certainly a possibility worth considering, and I do know there is some alternate history out there exploring that idea. But it would have been interesting if Glenn getting elected in 84 could kind of bring back the glory days of NASA to an extent and say, let's be explorers, let's carry on, and maybe could have pushed using the shuttle to build a space station, but also a reliable, we'll call it a tug, between the Earth and the Moon to start working on establishing a base in the early 90s.
And then years later, John Glenn could have become the oldest man in space and the first ever former US president in space.
Indeed.
That would have been cool.
To see.
Well, let's focus on 1986 now. Moving forward a little, I want to know what the implications of no Challenger disaster would have been. What would have happened as a result of that?
Well, it doesn't take much for Challenger not to happen. What you need is for a different decision to come out of a conference call between Morton Thiokol engineers and NASA management on the ground at the Kennedy Space Center. It's been dramatized in two or three different places.
Yeah.
Anybody who's interested in that, I recommend seeking those out. I suspect, of course don't know, that what not having a Challenger event in 86 means that there's a disaster later on. It's the same thing with Apollo 1. It makes everybody step back and go, oh, God, we've been flying a fairly dangerous machine here.
And
I mean, the shuttle was already having issues. They had launched the previous January of 1985 at something like 20-something degrees warmer and still had the same issue with the solid rocket boosters that ended up causing the Challenger explosion. And there had also been consistent issues with the shuttle brake failing on landing, which is not what you want with an unpowered spacecraft that has to fly like an airplane and has the aerodynamic characteristics of a brick. However, that disaster also, if you want a silver lining for this, would not have happened with the eyes of the world and particularly America's school children watching.
Of course, yeah, it was a big event leading up to it. And of course, there was a documentary about the woman who went into space.
Christa McAuliffe.
Yes. And I wonder what this would do politically and what this would do culturally in the 80s, because as you say, children were watching what happened. And a lot of people were heavily emotionally invested in what Christa McAuliffe was doing.
What would have happened is, and we already know that NASA was planning on expanding civilians going up on the shuttle. We know there was a journalist in space program that Walter Cronkite, who was a famous news anchor here in the United States, was a part of. Of all people who could have gone into space, the kid from A Christmas Story, who was the head of something called the Young Astronaut Program, doing outreach and whatnot, but he had basically been given the tap on the shoulder and said, you know, Christa McAuliffe works out, you're going to have a shot at it too.
Yeah.
He was actually in the stands that day watching this launch and the explosion that followed.
Well, yeah.
So you would have potentially had either one of those turn into a Challenger event, potentially. But, you know, if something goes wrong with the shuttle on landing, if those brakes fail, there's a decent chance somebody's going to walk out of the situation alive, compared to what happened with Challenger.
Yes.
Where nobody had the ability to walk out alive. We're fairly confident that at least three or four of the astronauts survived the explosion because their emergency oxygen supplies were turned on.
Mm.
And I can't imagine what hell that would have been like.
Let's come to the end of the Cold War. There was some talk of, once again, a joint US-Russian space exploration event taking place. Could more have been made of that?
Almost certainly. Apollo-Soyuz in the mid-70s really kind of lays the groundwork for international cooperation.
Mm.
That completely falls apart in 79.
Yeah.
And, of course, in the early years of the Reagan administration, when the Cold War goes frozen.
It ain't going to happen.
Yeah. But in the mid-late 80s, Reagan and Gorbachev, and that whole special relationship, for lack of a better phrase, might have developed something out of that. The Russians had the expertise through Mir and through the Soyuz stations of long-duration spaceflight. The U.S. had the technological know-how.
Mm.
And I could imagine in a slightly different scenario where, if not Reagan and Gorbachev, then certainly the first President Bush and Gorbachev maybe come together and said, let's combine expertise and bring them together, and let's do a mission to Mars. And in fact, might have been better received than the first President Bush's massive space exploration initiative.
Yes.
That ended up being basically dead on arrival.
I do wonder what the situation would have been like with that space exploration program had Bush been re-elected in 1992, however that would have happened.
Well, the thing that happens because of the SEI, as it becomes known, because, you know, government bureaucracies and space agencies love their acronyms. The problem with the SEI was that everybody in NASA put their pet project into it and made it an essential part of it, that there had to be a space station, the shuttle had to keep flying, you had to have a moon base, and you had to have Mars. That was what made it so expensive. And the fact of the matter is that it actually wasn't that expensive. There was a massive hundreds of billions of dollar price tag attached to it. But that was over a couple of decades. But nobody seemed to pay attention to that. They just heard giant number and government spending at the end of the Cold War and went, oh, thank you, but no thank you. What might have happened is a similar version of what's happened since, which is that because SEI is dead on arrival, Robert Zubrin at Martin Marietta and some other people there come up with the Mars Direct proposal. That's in the early 90s. And they basically spent half of the Bush administration walking around NASA and going to places and members of Congress and actually building up the support for it. And it was a lot more pared down. You have a couple of launches. You have a Habitat module that's going to get there first with a return vehicle. It was a lot simpler. It didn't require moon bases. It didn't require giant space stations. It could have been done relatively cheaply,
okay,
especially if you strike an international deal. And there was big support for it in the Bush administration. But, of course, Bush loses the 1992 election.
Yes, yeah.
And Bill Clinton coming in, particularly through Al Gore, is looking at the international situation. The Cold War's ended. All of these Russian missile scientists and rocket scientists and space people are unemployed suddenly. And the big fear is they're going to go to North Korea, they're going to go to Iran, they're going to go to what we would today call rogue states, and they're going to develop weapons of mass destruction and the way to deliver them. And that's where the ISS comes from. Because the ISS starts off as Reagan's Space Station Freedom proposed way back in 1984. But it was huge and it was expensive. And that was actually the way of getting it built, was to make it an international project. And it also meant that all these Russian scientists and engineers could be employed doing something besides building missiles for Saddam Hussein and anybody else.
Mm.
Because the 1992 election goes the way it does, Bob Zubrin and them have to basically start over. They influenced NASA planning, and indeed a version of Zubrin's Mars Direct planning is still there as the bedrock of what NASA is planning for future missions to Mars. But it might have actually have happened before the end of the century, not somewhere in the first quarter. Well, it's not going to be the first quarter. It's going to be somewhere in the second quarter of the 21st century.
Mm. How could a mission to Mars have happened in the first quarter of this century? So by now, basically, how could that have happened? What's the best way of getting that, say, with a point of departure in 2000?
So the big thing that might have happened in 2000 might have been George W. Bush standing up before he actually did, because he actually doesn't stand up and do anything major with space till 2004 after the Columbia disaster happens.
Yeah.
And starts everything going with what was initially as the Constellation program that is eventually going to morph under Obama into Orion and eventually Artemis, which is ongoing as of when
we speak. Yeah.
Bob Zubrin, in a documentary made in the late 90s, said if the next U.S. president-elect in 2001 stands up and does a JFK speech, we can have a human being on Mars in 2008. And he was absolutely right about that, and he remains absolutely right about that. You'd have needed the political will to actually put the money behind it. If Al Gore had come out during the 2000 election and said, this is what I'm going to do, it might have changed the outcome of the election in Florida.
We need either Bush to take more of an interest or a President Al Gore, ideally.
Yeah. And of course, this is all supposing what responses to 9/11 are, because that ends up sucking up the political atmosphere, as it were. With Gore, it would have been a different reaction that might have allowed different things to happen at once, including potentially a trip to Mars in 2010, say.
Before we finish, actually, let me just ask you a couple of other bits and pieces. I wonder what would have happened, what the consequences would have been of Europe being more involved in space travel at this time as well, because the EU started to make themselves heard, and of course China was ever growing at that point as well. Was there perhaps an opening for any of those guys?
The European Space Agency in the 70s and 80s is developing things, the Ariane booster, for example.
Mm.
As for a while, the largest space sort of rocket that's being launched anywhere on the planet before the shuttle comes along, in between the side of the eras of Apollo and the shuttle. And the European Space Agency, certainly in the 80s, had, I believe it was called Hermes, which was a proposal for a space plane using the Ariane vehicle as a launch thing. That was in many ways brought down by a Reagan administration's insistence that the shuttle could be all things for all people. China had been involved in the space thing dating back to the 70s, because they were launching their first satellites. And China's whole history of space stuff is interesting, because the founder of the Chinese space program was a immigrant from China to the United States. He was one of, I'm blanking on the guy's name, but he was one of those early people at JPL. But because of the McCarthy-era atmosphere of the early 1950s, he was deemed a security threat and shipped back to China. And once he proved that he was loyal to the new regime under Mao Zedong, he was able to convince them to start putting the money into rocket technology and eventually into the first Chinese satellite launched in 71. You know, there was speculation throughout the 80s into the early 90s that China was going to move into the human spaceflight arena, which they didn't do till the early 21st century.
We're going to move on now and briefly talk about the Columbia disaster. What would the implications, would there be many implications of that not happening?
The shuttle would still be flying, because NASA's plans pre-Columbia was to continue retrofitting the shuttle fleet. They wouldn't have built any more because it's hugely expensive and complicated flying machines. But NASA had plans to keep the shuttle fleet flying up till 2020, and we're exploring the possibility of keeping them flying even longer than that. So they could have become the spaceflight equivalent of, say, the B-52 bomber, say, you know, or the U-2 spy plane, these things that were developed, you know, decades ago that are flying well into the next century. But Columbia changed all of that and kind of exposed that NASA had become very complacent, I think is the word, on not focusing on the dangers of things. And that ends up changing the whole direction of spaceflight ever since, at least for the United States, because it's as a result of that and the commission that comes out of it that second President Bush, as we were talking earlier, stands up and says, we're going to go back to the moon and then Mars. If Columbia doesn't happen, the shuttle's going to keep flying. The question is, does another disaster of equal scale eventually occur?
And if something disastrous does happen, say under Obama, what would have happened then? Would he have reacted in the same way to W?
I think he would have. I think that's about the only reaction that anybody has at that point. Keep in mind that Obama actually extended the shuttle program for a couple of more years to let the program finish some work on the International Space Station, but also the Hubble Space Telescope. So I imagine the shuttle fleet would have been grounded and there would have begun a phasing out of them as happened in real life. What might have changed is that we did have basically a 10-year gap between the United States launching astronauts on the space shuttle and also being able to go to Elon Musk and SpaceX, where in the meantime we were having to pay, I can't remember how many millions, tens of millions of dollars a seat to the Russians to launch on Soyuz.
Yeah.
That might have been avoided, because that had already, in fact, started under Bush, that there had been a under Bush, and that really kind of extenuated, sort of becomes the thing in a big way under Obama, is this cooperation between NASA and companies like SpaceX or Bezos' Blue Origins.
This is the Alternate History Show. We revisit the past, change it, and see what happens. Enough said.
And it's another very special feedback hub on this edition of the Alternate History Show. Now, we're all doing our bit for the war effort in Ukraine and to help those who have been displaced by the fighting. And the Alternate History community is no different in that regard. And I'm pleased to say we're joined by, well, a few people now who are discussing Ukraine Amphology with us. We've got Alex Wallace. He's our regular contributor to the show, and he is with me now. Hello.
Nice to be here, as always, Ben.
And we've got Matthew Tressel as well, also joined by David Flynn today. Hello, David.
Hello there.
And Andy Cook is with us as well. Hi. Hi. Tell us about how you got into AH.
For me, it was first literary with Harry Turtledove when I was in my late teens, early 20s. Didn't realise it was a large area until I stumbled across alternate history online. Fell into a couple of... actually, it makes it sound like a kind of addictive drug, doesn't it? Fell into a couple of stories on there and then got tempted to start writing first political alternate history and then more widespread things, and one thing led to another. You just can't give it up, unfortunately.
I can see what you mean, actually, about how you kind of stumble across. That was very much my story anyway, stumbling across alternate history, not really realizing it was a genre in its own right, if that makes sense. And what about you, David?
Well, for me, it was more being led into it by my wife. Alison was very involved in what was then SOC History, What If, 20, 25 years back. Occasionally I was dragged in to provide supporting arguments for any line of argument that she made. When she died, she was doing a timeline which I finished off for her and continued ever since.
What was the timeline?
That timeline was called the Flashman option. The premise of that was that Britain part stayed out of World War One, part got in, effectively Didn't get involved in continental fighting, but did get involved in peripheral stuff. So-called because George MacDonald Fraser had Flashman say in Mr. American that this was what Britain should have done, and just took that premise and saw where it would go.
Well, let's talk about what we're here to talk about, ostensibly, which is the Ukraine anthology, which is out now. Proceeds going to help those who have been affected by the war in Ukraine. Alex, I want to start with you. How did it all come together? Has it been something that's been on the back burner for a while?
The idea came out pretty quickly after the war. A user on the Sea Lion Press forum named Sideways, Lena Werward, she wrote a very good novel for Sea Lion Press. She had two ideas, the anthology and the write-a-thon that happened a few weeks back, and I participated in that a bit. And so we figured that what Putin was doing was bad, and we should help them.
Yes.
And it flowed from there. The anthology is called Building a Better Future, edited by David Flynn. It was published through his imprint, Sergeant Frosty Press, and really, he is more qualified to talk about that aspect than I am.
We'll turn to you, David, about that, because say, it's out now. Were you particularly well acquainted with Ukrainian history generally before the war started back in sort of mid to late February time? It must have been a bit of a learning experience if you weren't then.
Exactly so. I mean, I'm familiar with little bits of Russian history, but predominantly my expertise is in putting together anthologies with Sergeant Frosty Publications. It's what I do. I've had fairly long experience being a trade press editor, where the whole premise is you pull together pieces by experts and stitch them together to make a coherent publication. I was very much dependent upon the people writing the stories knowing what they're talking about.
Did you do your own story as part of this then?
I did do a couple of stories in there. One was about a development of a class warfare. The idea there being that there are many aspects to building a better future involved, and some better futures are bad for other people and so on. I also did a second piece in there that they were essentially little fillers to keep things going. The bulk of the work was done by the authors.
Well, we'll turn to the rest of the authors right now. Matthew, let's talk about what you've done as part of this collaboration. What was your role?
So I actually saw that there was going to be an anthology kind of late at night, my time, about 11 o'clock. And I went, well, this is really interesting and I want to contribute something to this. But it's been a long day and I'm
best ideas. Best ideas do come at 11 o'clock at night, I find.
Well, you would think, but I certainly wasn't in the mood to come up with anything. So I went to bed thinking, okay, I'm going to sit down tomorrow and come up with something.
Right.
And I woke up the next morning, in fact, to a message from David, who had been looking through vignettes that had been posted on the Sea Lion Press forum going, I've seen this one particular vignette you did. I think this is a great fit. Would you mind if we used it? And what could I say besides, you know, absolutely, please run with it. So mine actually came from of all things, a Jerry Anderson theme. Vignette contest on the Sea Lion Press forum last summer, kind of premised on the idea of what might have happened if the much talked about but never arrived 1970s Ice Age had actually shown up. Sort of imagining, I think it's somebody on the forum put it, Arthur C. Clarke's 2010 meets Jerry Anderson. So that was what I sort of contributed to it, a story called Firestarter, and by good luck, David decided to put that as the opening story in the anthology. So I'm hoping that the quality goes up from there.
Modesty forebodes and all that. Okay, so that was your first. That's what you've done. What about you, Andy? Coming to you, what have you been doing as part of this anthology?
Well, I was writing a novel at the time, post-apocalyptic novel, Recovery from the Apocalypse, which happened to fit, but I couldn't actually A, finish a novel in time, and B, it would rather over-dominate a single book if you have a novel with other things around.
Yeah.
But I did work out that the first quarter of it could stand alone as a story following an apocalypse. You need to recover, you need to rebuild. And for one reason or another, I keep on coming back to apocalyptic stories. Maybe it's kind of a theme for me, but this one came about because my wife and I were watching 2012, the movie, which is a bit lame and unrealistic.
Yeah. I think it was meant to. That was the intention, very much, but yeah.
Yeah. Why didn't they just build a shed load of airships or something and save millions of people that way? So we went to an airship theme, and without giving too much away, that's how the people on board Skyborne survived the apocalypse. But you've also got to not just survive an apocalypse, but a decade and more later, you've got to recover, survive, yes, and rebuild.
Yes,
and
course,
with Ukraine, the rebuilding is going to be a massive part. So the idea is hope, rebuild, future after a catastrophe. The one thing I would actually say as well that David was too modest to bring forward.
All right.
David had the ideal skills for this because as a magazine editor,
yes,
which he's been in the past, you have to hit a deadline and do it fast and bring everything together,
yeah,
rapidly.
Definitely.
So because he's also been a book editor, this was a magazine come at the size of a book with the timescales needed to be hit. So yes, he was the driving force contacting us, bringing us all together. I think on most of these stories, most of us have begun or was already writing a story that would fit. And that's how we managed to all hit this insanely fast deadline, because to get a book out that rapidly after something like this, you have to have all the wind blowing in the right direction and the right people doing the right things at the right time.
Pretty Herculean task if ever there was one, and you did it within, well, where are we now, 2 months after hostilities started.
Start to finish, the book was 17 days.
17 days of very hard graft, I would imagine.
Yes, basically I dropped doing everything else and concentrated on that and kept pestering the authors to make sure they produced on time.
Excellent.
I had this vision of David just walking around in little circles after publication, wibbling slightly like, it's done, it's done.
You can literally just see the relief on his face and the shoulders just etching downwards.
We should say, too, that David was actually on the Sea Lion Press forum at least once, sometimes twice a day, posting updates saying, I've got this many things in, I'm waiting on getting this in, here's whose stories are going to be in here. And I have to say, just on the writing end of that, the transparency that David brought to that was incredibly welcome.
Yeah.
Having been in anthologies and stuff where I've sent stuff off and literally don't hear anything for 6 months to a year and all of a sudden, book's out. So I just wanted to say, well, I actually have kind of sort of face-to-face with David. Thank you for doing that.
No worries.
I don't think it will catch on, though, giving people 15 to 30 days to turn around an anthology. It is great for the authors to see the visibility.
Yes.
But we might burn out the editors quite rapidly.
That's very true. That's very true.
David was better about transparency than I was when I was editing my anthology that Matthew was in and is profiled on a previous episode of the Alternate History Show.
Yes, see, I'm Allo Americana.
David did it better than I did, and I had 15 months and he had 17 days.
Tell us the name of the anthology, please, David, one more time, and explain who else, what else is part of the anthology.
The anthology is called Building a Better Future. It contains 13 different stories, two of which are my own. We've got Matthew's Firestarter. There's one about the Holodomor Memorial Day, recalling previous events in Ukraine when the then Soviet Union caused problems. We've got Andy Cook's Skyborne towards the end, almost the closing piece being a substantial one. We've got Assignation by Jared Kavanagh. Thank You, Mr. Holmes is one of mine, which is looking at how the Baker Street irregulars might have viewed things.
Interesting.
They don't necessarily have a terribly high opinion of Mr. Holmes, who largely ignored them other than what they could do. The Next Day of Your Lives being a piece concerning a romance in a united Europe with an interesting take on a better future. Delenda Est is one which looks at how there might have been an improved history of America from Gary Oswald. The premise I took for the book was there is a need for building a better future in Ukraine once things are over.
Definitely.
There's going to be a huge amount of work involved. Different aspects of what a better future might involve are being looked into in the book. I tried to get a range of lengths, a range of themes, a range of styles, essentially trying to get the book such that there will be something in it that will appeal to someone.
Well, we can't say fairer than that. Something for everyone in their ranging, well, so many topics covered, I think. And it's available, of course, on the Sea Lion Press website, I would imagine.
There's a link there.
Also the Sergeant Frosty website.
Plug that for us.
Sergeant Frosty Publications, sergeantfrosty.com. If you look for Sergeant Frosty Publications through Google, you will come to it.
Which charities in particular are you supporting?
Well, it's the Disaster Emergency Committee from the Red Cross. To contribute directly, dec.com will get you to that appeal.
Thank you, David, Matthew, Andy and Alex and all the team. And don't forget to get the Ukraine anthology when you can. That's it for this edition of the Alternate History Show. I have been Ben Kearns. I will continue to be Ben Kearns. I'm back with another episode in July, so make sure you join me for that, when we'll be having fun with the Hanoverians. Until then, thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Alternate History Show on space travel. And a big thanks to Matthew for talking more about that. Don't forget, I want to hear from you about the show. I'm on the various Alternate History platforms, as is Alex Wallace, whether it's on Sea Lion Press, Alternate History Online, or alternatehistory.com. Get in contact with me. I'll be happy to hear from you. Meantime, see you in July.